In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to hour number two of the program for Friday, November 12, 2010 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It is, as we do every week at this time, the Federal News Countdown, where two experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories that they think are most important to people who work for the federal government, rank them in order from number three all the way to number one, and then come into the studio and count them down with me. And on the countdown this week, happy to welcome back Melissa Chapman, who's Vice President for Health Solutions at Agilex and the former CIO at the Department of Health and Human Services. Nice to see you, Melissa. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Happy to have you back. And John Kaminsky, Senior Fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, is my other expert this week. John, great to see you.
Well, thank you very much.
It is a noteworthy Federal News Countdown this week because, as I was just saying before we went on the air, it's the last one of November. Next week, I'll be out in Colonial Williamsburg with the family, enjoying that. My son's first trip there. And then the week after that is Thanksgiving weekend. So this is the last countdown for November. And it is a good one. Great selections, both of you, this week. And we'll get right to it with
number three.
Melissa Chapman's third most important federal news story of the week is headline, Feds Describe Major Push for Mobile Health Apps. And this is from Enterprise Mobile Today. And the thing that I think is interesting about this is, well, first of all, a plug that Todd Park, who's mentioned in here, is going to be on my panel at the Affirm Breakfast on Thursday. So I'm looking forward to talking to Todd about innovation at, in particular at HHS, but across government in general. But what I thought was really fascinating about this, Melissa, is this quote that Todd said, our open health data campaign is turning HHS into the NOAA of health data. What's he mean by that?
Right. Well, Todd Park, who's the chief technology officer at HHS right now, actually had some experience at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And as you may know from personal use, there's a tremendous amount of weather, environmental data, et cetera, at that site. And for the end consumer, for a scientist, a researcher, it's a great opportunity to access that information and do your own research. Similarly, with this open health data concept that HHS is implementing, it's an opportunity for anyone out there with the capability to access that data and build a range of applications. Certainly, and Todd mentioned this at the mHealth Summit last week. It's a tremendous way to ensure that the more leading edge tools like iPad, iPhone, Droid, BlackBerry, et cetera, that there's a chance to create particularly consumer access to critical information that can not only educate them about their personal health, but begin to create a higher baseline for the relative knowledge about healthcare in America today. Right now, there's a pretty big discrepancy between different demographics concerning their understanding of their own health. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the many ways to reconcile that.
Mm-hmm. I think this is really interesting because this is the ideas that Todd talks about in this piece are music to the ears of private sector developers who I think were afraid that the government was going to come in and develop all these apps themselves and suck all the oxygen out of that part of the room. And I think people are happy to hear that he's talking about the same kinds of things that Vivek talks about on a regular basis, which is we'll make this available, we'll manage it to the extent that we need to, and leave it for other people to do with as they choose.
And I want to mention one other item. This article, and there were several on the mHealth Summit this week, focuses on access to data. But I would like to also point out that the types of tools being created on these devices at Agilex, we're seeing a lot of change in how people do their jobs because of these tools. So in addition to access to information, we're changing the rate and mechanisms around how people do their job, not just in the healthcare community, but in others as well.
It's interesting stuff. The headline is Feds Describe Major Push for Mobile Health Apps. And you can find it later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It's Melissa Chapman's story number three on the Federal News Countdown this week. John, your story story number three is a Washington Post story headline, Federal Government Needs a Chief Operating Officer. Former Senator Bob Kerry joining Mark Alderman, a member of the President Obama's transition team, and Howard Schweitzer, who is the first Chief Operating Officer of TARP, writing this in the Post. And there, I know there are some people that probably see this and say, oh, just what we need, another federal something officer, chief something officer. But this argument, as you read down through it, it's really kind of hard to dismiss offhand like that, I think.
Well, I guess the question is at what level should this person be? Mm-hmm. In the article, it's saying that the chief of staff for the president should handle a lot of the political issues, and there should be almost like a parallel person that would handle government implementation execution.
Mm-hmm.
The article talks about how this is being done at the agency level. When I was working for Gore's Reinventing Government Initiative 16 years ago, we advocated the creation and each agency of a chief operating officer. And that was the deputy secretaries, and the deputy secretaries convened together as the president's management council on a regular basis now. And the head of that is the deputy director for management at OMB, who this president, President Obama, is designated as also being the government's chief performance officer. So kind of that role of chief operating officer for the federal government, that's not there in name, but in fact, I think that Jeff Zients does serve in that kind of capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question in the article is does he have enough clout to be able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
In past administrations, that role of deputy director for management focused on the capacity building for management in agencies as opposed to the delivery of services. And it's not clear whether that's what the intent of this chief operating officer would be.
I get a sense, too, from what is written in this piece that these three gentlemen would like to see this person reside and operate from the White House more so than from OMB.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience at OMB, is there a difference when someone speaks from the White House rather than when someone speaks from OMB, that the location of this job would be that critical?
I don't know. When I worked for Vice President Gore, I was also dual-hatted as being an OMB senior executive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would go out and speak, sometimes I would say, oh, I work for Vice President Gore, and people would go, oh, that's interesting. And other people, I would say, I work for OMB, and they go, oh, my God, you work for OMB. So I think the perception some people think that OMB is far more powerful than the White House,
mm-hmm,
in some cases. So I guess it depends on who you're talking to. But I think that the key thing is what's the role of this individual? And when there was discussion of creating the chief performance officer after Obama was elected, the question was, would this be a separate person? Because he said during his campaign, this would be somebody who reports directly to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there was pushback by Congress, by GAO, and others, is saying that person is not senatorially confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to have access because we want to have oversight ability over that position. So my guess is that's why Zients is dual-hatted as opposed to being a separate standalone chief performance officer, is there,
mm-hmm,
needed to be a link back to the legislative world.
Yeah.
And if you had a chief performance officer or a chief operating officer like this, would this be somebody that would be presidentially appointed and senatorially confirmed? And if so, that begins to break the tradition of the White House staff being reporting only to the president and cannot testify before Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So that question hasn't been resolved.
The details of this are available at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It's a Washington Post op-ed piece from former Senator Bob Kerry, Mark Alderman, and Howard Schweitzer. It's headlined, Federal Government Needs a Chief Operating Officer, and it appeared in the Washington Post, and you can find it on our website, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It is John Kamensky's story number three on the Federal News Countdown. That takes us to story number two from John and also from Melissa Chapman of AgileX. We'll get into those in just a few moments on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
Hi. Hi, this is Jim Fleisig. Please join me on Thursday, November 18th at 12 noon for my monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. Our program this month will discuss cloud computing initiatives in the federal government. The panel includes government leaders from the U.S. Army, DISA, and NIST. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum on Thursday, November 18th at noon, right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com.
Sponsored by McAfee, Riverbed, and Red Hat.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit MyVillageGreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Garden of Life and Himalaya Herbal Healthcare.
The Internet is more than just a technology. It's a domain, similar to the domains of land, air, sea, and space, but with its own distinct challenges. The cyber domain has national and international dimensions that include industry, trade, intellectual property, security, technology, culture, policy, and diplomacy. It includes all parts of the converged network, from computer networks to satellite communications, and is not bound by international borders. How can the United States shape the global cyber landscape to promote U.S. economic interests and develop a cyber domain that considers transparency, accessibility, security, and privacy? Listen to Cyber 2020, The Future of the Internet, as part of the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices panel series, moderated by Executive Vice President Mike McConnell and featuring top government and commercial experts, November 17th at 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. For more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen, or visit boozallen.com/expert. Voices.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. Now that the Deficit Commission has floated its recommendations, we'll get reaction from the most famous prophet for reining in the national debt. Plus, we'll tell you about a special event in Washington exclusively for female members of the military and veterans. All that and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, check out our website, federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week is being the stories chosen by John Kaminsky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Melissa Chapman of Agilex. And we're up to
number two.
Melissa Chapman's second most important story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline, Healthcare Law Here to Stay for Now. And one of the things in the election last week that people believe got a lot of Republicans elected, to, especially to the House of Representatives, was promise to repeal President Obama's healthcare law. This piece in the Post makes it sound like that's not likely to happen anytime soon. What's the implication for the agencies that are affected by the healthcare law? Your former agency at HHS, Medicare, Medicaid, and so on.
Right. And I just want to say, while this is a late post-election announcement, I think you still deserve the big screen TVs and automatic graphics tools that CNN and Fox have.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. They don't work as well on radio, we've found. It's hard for people to say, let's look at the board and...
Well, we could do something with sound.
That's a great idea. Make it lots of whooshes and stuff like that.
There you go.
I think it's a great idea.
Oh, you know, and looking at this story, it's a little challenging maybe for anyone to look at, because there's the personal concern. What is this going to mean for healthcare reform, whether you were pro or con? There's a concern at the level of working for companies like John and I work for. What does this mean for opportunities down the road that we might be able to support with solutions and ideas? And then thirdly, what does it mean in terms of the businesses that are out there and how they're going to be able to go forward and plan for what the actual implementation means? And you asked, what does it mean for HHS? In this article, it talks about Secretary Sebelius at HHS thinks that they'll be able to go forward within the funds available today to meet the commitments that they've made under the reform bill already. But in particular, I'd like to call out the requirement for states who also have received mm-hmm. funding to begin to build the health insurance exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
There is a pretty big gap between who's finished, who's getting started, and who's still worrying about it. And those states are going to have to look at this change in Congress as well and decide how they want to move forward
mm-hmm.
Most prudently. Additionally, the bill, you know, and for many reasons, pushed the money out to the states. But as a backup plan, HHS is expected to be able to implement a nationwide solution in the event that the states aren't ready.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't envy the individuals in HHS that have to make a decision about how to keep going forward and how to manage those investments best. It won't behoove anyone in the future to say, well, Congress changed and we didn't know what to do. They'll
mm-hmm.
have to keep going with their mandate.
Now, there are a number of states that are suing over this law. One of them is the Commonwealth of Virginia. The Attorney General there has sued. I saw a note this morning that Governor Poletti in Minnesota is suing. Is that what they're suing over, the requirement that the states establish these exchanges?
There's a few aspects of the bill that are being sued over, and we're going to have to watch what happens with the first few suits that are litigated because of the establishment of case law.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of suits will go away depending on the findings of the first few. So it's a little difficult to compare. You really have to get down to a level of detail about what's specifically behind the suit, what in their minds justifies
mm-hmm.
the suit.
John, from a management perspective, how do you manage at an agency like this, and not just when it's regarding healthcare, but at any level of uncertainty about policy that you thought was established and now may or may not be as established as you thought it was? Do you just keep plowing forward as though what you're dealing with today is what you're going to be dealing with a year from now?
Well, that's what's going to happen at the frontline level.
Yeah.
They're going to have to continue planning because this is the law and they have to faithfully implement the law.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going to be very challenging is you have 26 new governors. And what are they going to do and how do they want to approach it? And the states are going to have a huge responsibility in implementing this. I mean, there's a big implication for a lot of different federal agencies, but there's an enormous amount of reliance on the states to actually be able to deliver on this. And how the states approach this is sort of a wild card,
mm-hmm.
and it'll be 50 wild cards.
Yeah. The challenges of this just seem myriad, and I wonder, given the fact that we're likely to see, a lot of people are predicting gridlock over the next couple of years, maybe nothing will happen, and by nothing else happening, what we've got now is likely to stay exactly where it is. And that's kind of what this piece gets to, Melissa.
Well, some things will go forward. Gridlock means go forward.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
The law now has been passed. President signed it, and so since nobody will be able to tamper with it, because nobody will really be able to get House and Senate to agree on doing anything, that the way it stands now is what we'll have to deal with.
And there's still a lot more work to be done. Despite the physical size of the bill, the number of pages, there are a lot of items that both sides want to address that remain on the list,
mm-hmm.
tort reform being very high mm-hmm. on the list. So it would be discouraging to think that in the midst of gridlock over what's been passed, that the remaining list is not addressed at all.
Mm-hmm. The headline is "Healthcare Law Likely to Stay for Now." It's from the Washington Post, and it is the number two story of the week, according to Melissa Chapman of Agilex on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. John Kaminsky's story number two is up next when the countdown continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
If smoked salmon is on the menu or being served at an upcoming holiday gathering, you can thank scientists with the Department of Agriculture for doing their part to ensure it's safe to eat. They say they've developed a first-of-its-kind mathematical model that food processors can use to select the perfect combination of temperature and concentrations of salt and smoke compounds in order to reduce or eliminate the possibility of contaminated smoked salmon making its way to market. USDA researchers say smoked salmon is typically sold in packages that have a refrigerator shelf life of about 3 to 8 weeks, since dangerous microbes can live at refrigerator temperatures. They say it's important to get rid of the microbes before the packages leave the processing plant.
General Dynamics Information Technology, delivering the strength of technology to achieve mission success. General Dynamics IT. Visit GDIT.com to learn more.
Listen next week for a special edition of the Business of Government Hours Conversation with Authors series, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. What are the benefits of regulatory partnerships? How can new approaches to public-private partnerships enhance food safety? Join host Michael Keegan as he profiles three IBM Center reports and explores these questions and more with authors Russ Mills, Cassandra Mosley, professors Noel Grice, and Monica Noguera. Next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Profile America, Friday, November 12th. Today, the 28th annual Triple Crown of Surfing kicks off on the north shore of the island of Oahu in Hawaii. The event includes three professional big wave surf meets, marking the end of the year-long tour by the Association of Surfing Professionals. Some 30,000 people are expected from all over the world to jam the beach in the next month to watch the very best men and women surfers battle the island's gigantic surf in their search for the perfect wave. Millions more will thrill to the action on television. Surfboards are among the nearly $12 billion worth of sporting and athletic goods made in the U.S. each year. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau, online at census.gov.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight for November is the March of Dimes. Do you know a baby who was born too soon, too small, or unable to breathe on his own? With one in every eight babies born prematurely, you probably do. The rate of premature birth has risen more than 30% since 1981. In half the cases, they simply don't understand what went wrong. November is Prematurity Awareness Month, and March of Dimes is leading the fight for answers and preventions. Learn more. Visit federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown, where every week at this time, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the three most important federal news stories of the week as they see them, rank them in order from number three to number one, and then come in the studio, count them down with me on the Federal News Countdown every Friday at 2 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests this week are Melissa Chapman of Agilex and John Kamensky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And John, your story number two this week is from GovExec. The headline is Administration Announces Finalists in Cost-Cutting Contest. And this is a story about the SAVE Awards, which we've talked about this week at Federal News Radio. And some of these are pretty interesting. The final four are advertised property seized by Customs and Border Protection online rather than in newspapers, and automatic delivery of the Federal Register's hard copies to employees and make people sign up to receive them instead of getting them automatically. Use ground shipping rather than express service to return empty lab sample containers to the Food Safety and Inspection Service at the Ag Department, and require mine operators to complete quarterly data reports online rather than in mailed paper forms. Now, I don't want to disrespect any of the people that submitted these, because they're good ideas, and I think all of them should be implemented. Mm-hmm. But they kind of strike me, for someone of your managerial experience, as no-brainers, the kind of thing where you walk around the first day you're in a new job and say, oh, you're doing it that way? Stop doing it that way. Am I off base on that, do you think?
Well, it's not when you're new and you're a manager and you go around and you tell people what to do. I think what you need to do is ask people. Mm-hmm. And this is what they've done, is they've asked people. I think that the power of asking people, are there silly things that are going on in your operation that you see that can be fixed? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, people can't seem to change it at their level because it's the way that's been done. What we tried to do in the Reinventing Government initiative 15 years ago or so is to empower employees to be able to fix things in their operation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they had the reinvention labs where they could try new things and sort of not have to follow agency rules necessarily, but they could try new things and see if they could save. We saw one operation that in West Virginia with the Department of Energy that decided they were going to try something new, and they saved like $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having these people would come to Washington occasionally and just proudly tell us what they're doing. And we had some people from Germany and watching, some senior executives, and they were saying, did you have permission from the secretary? And he says, no, we never told her. You saved $100 million, you never even told your boss? No, we just are doing this because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how do you create that kind of energy and enthusiasm? And the SAVE Award can do that, but it's almost a shame that for 18,000 ideas, they pick one.
Mm-hmm.
Why not pick, instead of 40, or 400,
yeah.
Or 4,000,
yeah.
And really celebrate this. One of the things, the other thing, that when we were giving Vice President Hammer Awards for reinventing government,
mm-hmm.
To teams that were doing the right thing, people were criticizing us, saying, well, you're giving out too many. And we're saying, the goal isn't to restrict the number. The goal is to increase the number. If there are more people,
yeah.
And more teams that are doing great stuff, recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there a way to turn the SAVE Award into something that's a much broader recognition, celebration of just doing smart things?
That kind of mindset is exactly the mindset that makes people bananas about what goes on in government. The you're giving out too many awards for success and innovation kind of thing, Melissa. How do you turn that around?
That's right. It's very difficult to truly push down accountability and decision-making to the right levels. Often, as John mentioned, there are long-standing procedures in place and the notion that you follow those rules no matter what. So it does take a few brave souls to step up and say, let's make some simple changes that matter. And again, a lot of times the incentives are not in place. At
mm-hmm.
the highest level, for those folks responsible for the budget, saving is not encouraged because you know that if you don't spend everything that's allotted to you for the year, you don't get it again next year.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you need that for another project, and the process of doing that is very challenging. So in a way, there needs to be a fundamental redesign of how we incentivize particularly government employees at their own level of responsibility to find savings.
The idea of grandfathering that top line where if you save X number of dollars, you do get to keep that money next year, that's been talked about too, but that's not necessarily the answer, is it, do you think?
No, not necessarily, because it's not the amount of money, it's
mm-hmm.
what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And if people focus on what you're trying to achieve as opposed to how much money you get, that's a very different way of framing.
Mm-hmm.
And could you imagine a place like, you know, GM or General Electric saying we got to spend everything before the end of the year, as opposed to, gee, if we save money, we can, you know, have stock returns
mm-hmm.
or better stock prices. It's just the notion or the thinking is just flip in the public versus the private sector. And it's how do you wind up creating that mindset in the public sector.
Now, this is a secret ballot that you can vote at saveaward.gov in the privacy of your own home or office. But you said you voted.
Yes,
when we were off
anybody
the air.
Can vote.
Right, anybody can vote for these. Saveaward.gov, do you want to reveal the one?
Until 8 p.m. tonight.
Oh, okay.
So you've got until then.
Do you want to reveal the one that you voted for, or
well,
do you want to keep it secret?
These are all, in a way, symbolic
mm-hmm.
of ways of improving government operations. And to me, the one of using regular ground shipping instead of express mail to return empty boxes
mm-hmm.
sounded like a really nice way of saying do things smarter.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's interesting is this could be done absent legislation and absent the budget office doing anything. This could be done at the ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of what needs to be done to empower people to just do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, have you voted yet?
Not yet.
As soon as you leave here, of course you will.
On my mobile device,
excellent.
I will vote. And John should put you on the spot as well.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely going to vote as soon as the show is over while I listen to the Dorbeck Insider. Which one are you going to vote for, do you think? Do you know yet? You got to check them all out again.
I'm going to check them out again. I bet you there's more information up on the website about each of these.
I think my favorite one is the automatic delivery of the Federal Register.
8,000 copies a day.
Yeah, and you can read it online. I mean, it's really...
Well, with the new federalregister.gov, that is much more readable than the real one.
Than the book, yeah. All of the choices are online at saveaward.gov. It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth for your voting pleasure. And the headline on John Kamensky's story number 2 in the Federal News Countdown this week is Administration Announces Finalists in Cost-Cutting Contest, a story about the Save Awards. And you can see it on the in-depth page at federalnewsradio.com. We're up to story number 1 from John Kamensky and Melissa Chapman on the Countdown this week. And we'll count them down to number 1 in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Eagles fans, you're invited to a special live taping of the Jeff Jones Coaches Show Saturday morning, November 13 at 10:45 a.m. at Potomac Pizza, just off Wisconsin Avenue and Friendship Heights. Join us for brunch with the coach and enjoy some great pizza and sandwiches with our friends at Potomac Pizza. We'll recap the opening night game versus St. Francis and look ahead to the rest of the season with special guest callers. Get lunch and get knowledge during the Jeff Jones Coaches Show Saturday, November 13th at 10:45 a.m. at Potomac Pizza and Friendship Heights. Visit AUEagles.com for complete show information.
The latest from the Federal Security Spotlight brought to you by Cisco.
Having one collection of cyber threats means network administrators can check them out side by side. Here's Chris Johnson of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, specializing in the National Vulnerabilities Database.
And the great thing about having a consistent metric that you can use across a range of products is really you can compare apples to apples. In the past, we had different vendors using different scoring systems to represent risk related to vulnerabilities.
To hear the entire show, log on to federalnewsradio.com. Will the top-of-mind security issues of today be the issues facing government tomorrow? Get the latest from federal experts on FISMA reform, the cyber initiative, how government is combating botnets, spyware, and other cyber evils, and more. Listen to Federal Security Spotlight, sponsored by Cisco, airing Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. or on demand at federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Security Spotlight is brought to you by Cisco, the leader in federal IT security.
Newsmakers on the Dorabeck Insider.
Tom Trabucco, he is the Director of External Affairs at the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board.
Since the measurement on contributions to 401ks and the TSP is similar to the measurement used to determine an increase in Social Security benefits, and those have already been determined to not have an increase, I would be very surprised if there were an increase in the IRS limits this year.
Hear the entire interview online. federalnewsradio.com/Dorabeck Insider. There's a new show in town for the connected, curious, and innovative. Chris Dorabeck hosts the brand new Dorabeck Insider, weekdays from 3 to 7 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Only Chris has the energy and the Rolodex to bring you inside the decision-making that changes your workday. He challenges conventional wisdom by asking his high-profile guests about what worked and what didn't. The Dorabeck Insider is information sharing on the radio in the government 2.0 world. The Dorabeck Insider, weekday afternoons from 3 to 7 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week is featuring John Kamensky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Melissa Chapman of Agilex, the former CIO at HHS. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Melissa Chapman, is a Washington Post story by Rob Stein. The headline reads, Review of Prostate Cancer Drug Provenge. Did I pronounce that right? Provenge. Renews medical cost-benefit debate. And I thought this was really striking, Melissa, because it, as I read through this, I thought back to the discussion about rationing in health care. And this is pretty much the discussion about whether you should or how you would go about doing that, because this treatment, according to this article, costs $93,000 a patient and has been shown to extend patients' lives by about 4 months. Now, as I read through that, I had two questions. First of all, the first question was, I guess, how do you decide whether somebody's life, four extra months worth of life, is worth $93,000. The other one's, why does it cost $93,000 for this drug?
And let's start there, because we're going to see a lot of expensive drugs and therapies coming up in the near future. Prevent is unusual in that it's a vaccine that's administered after you have the condition or disease, in this case, prostate cancer. About 3 days before your inspected infusion, your own immune cells are extracted from you, and then the vaccine itself is generated based on those immune cells. So you can imagine that's a very complicated, expensive process, and it's a vaccine that's unique to you. So there's no way to scale the manufacturing, and that's certainly what's contributing to the incredible costs that we're seeing here. Now, under normal circumstances, this would be a drug that Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and other private insurance companies would certainly want to consider covering, particularly because it lengthens life. And there may even be circumstances where you could use the infusion repeatedly, so perhaps a longer extension of life as well, depending on the nature of the patient's condition. But what's challenging is, given the cost and the extension of life, it immediately begs the question, how much is a day of life worth? And do people want insurance companies or even the government deciding whether or not it's worth distributing those funds for that particular condition? And that, you know, touches on a fear base that a lot of people hinted at during the debating of the health care reform bill. There were certainly there was a lot of extreme language around death panels and other concerns, depending on your interpretation of that bill. What I'd like to focus on is the fact that FDA, NIH, and others are really aiming their efforts and their strengths on how do you reduce the cost in terms of manufacturing and the technology that's necessary to do this. Food and Drug Administration has a project that's long established called the Critical Path Program, and that focuses experts from around the world, private researchers, public researchers, on how do we create new technologies, new approaches to developing drugs and therapeutic biologics that lower the cost. On this program, Francis, in the past, we've talked about how that's the biggest contributor to healthcare costs are the drugs. Medicine is drugs. And so that's something we really have to focus on. And unfortunately, we're at a time right now in the technology where we're still going to have to deal with these incredible costs. And how do you ensure that we are not making decisions around coverage based on demographics or quality of life that's being determined by someone outside of the patient or the patient's family?
John, this story has every single icky, uncomfortable element that was discussed about during the debate on healthcare when the bill was up in Congress. There is even an element of, as Melissa alluded to, demographics. There is one claim in this story from Thomas Farrington, president of the Prostate Health Education Network, that the men most impacted by prostate cancer are African American men. And so the just every bad thing that you would possibly have to deal with, wrestle with, is there's an element of it in here, it seems. I guess just even trying to negotiate some of these things, trying to manage some of these issues without even making the final decisions, the concept of dealing with them must just be mind-blowing to the people that have to deal with them.
Well, I think that one way of approaching it is start with the assumption or the lens that what if this was free? If it was free, would you still do it? And are there consequences? Are there side effects? Are there this quality of life issues that are related to it? I mean, sometimes medical treatment is almost a form of abuse to some people in terms of the pain or the discomfort that they have to go through on this. And I think starting and so that's approaching it more from the medical end as opposed to from the green eye shades lens.
There are a lot of folks that would look at it that way and decide, you know, if this is what it takes, then I'm not even interested in this kind of treatment. Melissa, from the healthcare provision point of view, would you look at it the same way?
I think there's a lot of dimensions to this, unfortunately. Just to make it a little more complicated, this article also makes reference to a drug that FDA is considering withdrawing, Avastin, for breast cancer, another very expensive product. So the decision-making process is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just for this particular drug at this particular time should we cover it, but you have to continually monitor the efficacy of these mm-hmm. products and make that decision on a routine basis. And that's very challenging and gets personal very quickly mm-hmm. for people who are suffering from these conditions.
Melissa Chapman, story number one on the Federal News Countdown this week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Review of Prostate Cancer Drug Provenge Renews Medical Cost-Benefit Debate. You can find it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. John Kaminsky's story number one will reach into your pocket. We'll talk about that on the Federal News Countdown when we continue on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Eric.
100 years after his death, a black Union Civil War vet from South Carolina finally has a veteran's marker on his grave. The white gravestone for Henry Benjamin Noisette was dedicated yesterday during a Veterans Day ceremony at a small black cemetery near an interstate. Noisette's military past was not discovered until recently by a researcher at the African American Historical Alliance. Noisette escaped slavery in 1862. And join the U.S. Navy. I'm J.J. Green.
Can you imagine the size of an aircraft hangar that can hold four C-130 military aircraft simultaneously? Erink can. Erink operates the largest commercial hangar in Oklahoma City. As an FAA Part 145 repair station, Erink's team delivers advanced special mission capabilities, reverse engineering of obsolete parts, along with aircraft modifications, avionics upgrades, systems integration, and more. Log on to arinc.com to learn more.
Join host Jane Norris for the new Fed Central program on Wednesday, November 17th at 1 p.m. She will be joined by David McClure, Associate Administrator, Citizen Services and Innovation Technologies at the General Services Administration, and Ira Goldstein, Director with Deloitte's Federal Government Services and former Chief Operations Officer at GAO, as they discuss how open government is working for federal agencies. Don't miss Deloitte's Fed Central program on Wednesday, November 17th at 1 p.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Connect with more than 800 fellow contract management professionals. The Government Contract Management Conference is a must-attend on December 9th and 10th. The National Contract Management Association presents more than 20 educational sessions to answer the most complex questions, plus prominent speakers from CACI, the Department of Defense, the Boeing Company, and more. To learn more, visit ncmahq.org today.
Thanks for listening to the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Melissa Chapman of Agilex and John Kaminsky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government are choosing the stories on the Federal News Countdown this week. And John, your story number one reaches into just about every federal employee's pocket. It's a story from the Post with the headline, Federal Workers' Sacrifice Would Help U.S. Debt, Deficit Panel Says. It's a Joe Davidson story from the Post. And this deficit panel has created quite a furor, and their final report's not even out yet. It's just a draft report. It's available at federalnewsradio.com. Got it posted there, but we're still waiting for the final report, and already people are starting to get all in an uproar about this.
Well, there's three different deficit panels, and the one that this one is, the story is about, is the one that reports on December 1st. There mm-hmm. was another deficit panel that actually reported the same day this story came out, and it sort of got overwhelmed. It was from the a bipartisan panel about the budget process.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another one that's due out next week, I think on the 17th, from another bipartisan group. So there's different groups that are out there, but the only one that everybody's listening to is the one that President Obama appointed.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just the chairman, the two co-chairs that were just laying some things out there, I think, trying to get people's attention, and I think they did.
Yeah, I think they certainly did. I wondered how much of it was just a trial balloon to see what they thought they could actually get into the final report to then be able to say years from now that their final report, and not for their own personal gratification or image, but for the idea that this is what we suggested and this stuff actually happened, and I wondered how much of that might be at play here.
The big picture is that if you want to, the general consensus, you need to get the federal deficit down to about 60% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
To do that over the next 10 years is cutting $7 trillion. Their proposal addresses half of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like there are some people criticizing this as not being bold enough.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when you talk about things like putting a freeze on federal salaries and bonuses and other compensation for 3 years, and that's saving $15 billion out of $7
trillion? Mm-hmm.
So what needs to happen is so much greater than even the scary stuff that's facing federal employees on the front line. Now, what hasn't been discussed, and I think that the conversation somehow needs to reframe, is this is a focus on inputs. This is a focus on dollars. This is a focus on spending. There's not a conversation about what do we as a nation want to achieve. What is it that we want in terms of outputs or outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
Just saying for another proposal was that they can double the cuts that are planned in the Defense Department, save $5 billion. Well, what are you cutting? You can't just talk about dollars. You need to talk about what the reality of it is. And if you begin having citizens reframe, do we have Social Security or national defense or border or whatever it is, and talk about, well, we don't need a border fence, or we don't need high-speed rail, or we don't need to be doing X or Y, then say, okay, and that'll save you X amount of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you have to focus not just on the inputs, but also the outputs and outcomes at the same time, and nobody is having that conversation.
That's an excellent point. Also, there was another article this week in USA Today. USA Today did an analysis that finds the number of federal workers earning $150,000 or more
mm-hmm.
has doubled since President Obama took office.
Mm-hmm.
And people see a story like that and get outraged about how much money they perceive federal workers are making. At the same time, you have to take a look at, well, what is that investment being made in? What kind of individuals, what kind of expertise is being brought into mm-hmm. the government? And what's the return on that? Mm-hmm. It can be an incredible return depending on the quality of the folks brought in. So you really have to do a far deeper analysis than just a blanket notion of what to cut and what to keep.
I had that conversation with Chris Dorbeck earlier this week. In particular, the example that came to my mind was TARP, and when the government had to go and hire a whole bunch of attorneys to make sure that the money that was being paid out was being paid out right, I told Chris, I want some really, really good attorney that's going to cost me as a taxpayer a lot of money across the table from the best attorneys that the financial institutions can buy, because they can afford it. We should be able to afford it too. And those people don't make a $50,000 a year.
That's right.
Those people make some good money.
Well, it's thinking it through. When you say that one of the other proposals is only hire two for every three people that are retiring, well, what are you doing? The FAA, air traffic control, I think something like 60 or 70% of their people are retiring in mm-hmm. the next few years. It takes 4 years to train somebody to be certified. What do you just say? Airlines, we're not allowing you to fly this week because we don't have enough controllers.
I think everybody agrees that that's the approach. The issue is, this is, I think, a lot bigger than a lot of people are really allowing themselves to believe. Senator Judd Gregg, who's retiring and going back to New Hampshire at the end of this Congress, has been making the rounds on TV everywhere in the media that he can, and essentially saying, we're Greece. We are going to be in the same situation Greece is in now in 7 to 10 years, is the number he's putting on it. And I haven't heard one single person say, oh, Senator Gregg's just making trying to make a bunch of hay. He's full of it. And I would certainly think with a proclamation like that, if somebody didn't believe it, they'd say something about it.
Well, for example, if you did not pay the Defense Department budget or any Social Security this year, we would then be able to balance the budget.
Mm-hmm.
this year.
Right.
Because one-third of all the spending in the federal government this year is borrowed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just astonishing.
Yeah, it's really an unbelievable number. And I guess the problem that I don't think has been focused on enough is that we're borrowing the money mostly from people that don't really like us that much and would like to see us be unsuccessful.
Right. And how is that influencing our foreign policy?
Well, and that's, then you open a whole other can of worms. Yeah. The National Treasury Employees Union, of course, came in very quickly. Colleen Kelly saying if enacted, the proposals in the draft report would have an unfair and disproportionate impact on the federal employee and retiree community. And she's not wrong about that. That's what makes this so challenging. We're seeing the same kind of thing happening in England right now. Mm-hmm. College kids are rioting in the streets, literally rioting in the streets because they're going to have to pay a lot more. David Cameron's government is taking away a lot of the government subsidies for higher education there. And there's no reason to think that things like that can't happen here. And it's funny, my wife and I were having this discussion maybe a week or so ago. She's a teacher in Montgomery County Public Schools. And the issue is not whether these are good ideas or not, not whether we would like to do these things or not, but at what point do you say, we just don't have any more money and we don't want to borrow any more money?
Well, the British are very, very courageous. They're cutting their budget by almost 20% over the next 5 years. That's just unfathomable in this country.
Is there a possibility that we could get to that at some point? I mean, if what he's talking about is correct, we may be forced to do that. 7 to 10 years is the time frame he's given.
It'd be nice to do it before.
Well, and not be in a situation that Greece is in where of course a lot of their rioting was from people being upset because they were raising the retirement age from 60 to 62. That was the same issue in France, mm-hmm. where the French were all in an uproar because they would have to wait until the ripe old age of 62 to retire. I don't expect that I'm going to be retiring at age 62 anyway, so. I would think at that age, I would want to keep working, keep enjoying life. Because don't they keep saying 60 is the new, 60 is the new 70 or 70 is the new 60? I don't know how that works.
I hope so.
But I think they're also.
Well, you have like 30 or 40 years to worry about it, Melissa, though.
I think it depends on what you're doing. You know, if you're a mine worker, that's not the same thing as sitting here.
Yeah, really complicated issues. And the number one story of the week is chosen by John Kamensky is headline, Federal Worker Sacrifice Would Help U.S. Debt, the Deficit Panel says. It's from the Washington Post. It's available online at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Thank you, Melissa Chapman of Agilex. Thank you, John Kamensky, the IBM Center for the Business of Government, for this Federal News Countdown. The Dorabeck Insider's up next between 3 and 7 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.